when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day there, I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. This is Democracy Sausage Extra, and I'm delighted to say that I'm speaking to you today from paradise, one version of it anyway, because I'm in northern New South Wales, in literal rainforest country. That's right, I've gone as far north as one can go without breaking some pretty dubious laws imposed by the Queensland government in this strange COVID-fragmented country of ours. And I'm speaking today with someone who knows this region very well indeed. He's a former long-standing New South Wales Greens member of the state upper house, Ian Cohen. Ian, welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
Now, before we discuss the Greens, the state of politics, the state of activism, and I guess a little of your own story, I wonder if you wouldn't mind sketching a bit about the country that we're sitting in right now, where you now live here in northern New South Wales. Just tell us a bit about this particular place that we're in.
Well, I looked long and hard and kept coming back to the beauty of Broken Head and the ruggedness of the area, in great part because it's a hilly rise surrounded by plains and flat beaches, which they sand mined in the past. So there's been quite an alteration to the landforms on the beaches and their ability to withstand all weather conditions. But this particular area is very ancient rocky outcrops, which are a line between different geological systems. And it's much older than the Mount Warning caldera system. And so it's got quite a few features, not only geologically, coastal, also species-wise. And it's a tiny patch that didn't get broken down and developed and urbanized because it was so rocky and hilly. So this forest has been able to survive through some pretty intense farming practices of 50 to 150 years ago. And so it's got quite a history. It's got a very strong Aboriginal history, and it's a very beautiful area and a place where we can actually just let the forest grow and let the ecology come back without any great deal of assistance. So that's where I chose to live. Being a greenie, I wanted to live in the forest, and again, being a greenie, I wanted to save a bit of forest as part of my living experience, and it is. It's rugged, sometimes inconvenient, sometimes a bit of a challenge. But at the same time, we're surrounded by coastal development, and I'd certainly rather be surrounded by trees.
Yeah. So Broken Head is a little bit south of Byron Bay, which, of course, everybody in Australia knows about. It's essentially the easternmost point of the of mainland Australia, Byron Bay, that is. And people, of course, are well aware, I think, who've watched the news at all, of erosion. You mentioned erosion being a big issue in Byron Bay, for example, this part of the coast, because of a number of things. But, of course, you know, general broader environmental forces as well, rising sea levels, greater turbulence and the like. This part of the coast, as you say, are far less affected by that. The beaches are probably in a more natural state as a result.
Yeah, they're protected by their natural landform. And that's really reassuring. And a lot of the areas like the Belongil and down at Lennox Head, the beaches are a retreat zone. And so there's always that issue. And it's all the way along the coast, there are sections that are protected and sections that are retreat zones. And so when we had earlier councils, they worked with the scientific community, talking and quite strongly proving, although coastal geomorphology is a bit of a mystery to everybody, even the experts. You can't really totally understand the incredible complexities of wave patterns and impacts. But we worked with scientists. One leading scientist, Bruce Tom, who were adamant that councils need to adopt a retreat strategy. It's the best way to do it, and the natural coastline comes and goes over ages. Well, that clashes directly with the real estate industry and the love of Australians to have a beachfront dwelling. Yeah, and so that is an incredible cultural clash, and it's been very difficult. In a lot of ways, we look like losing that under this current state government and also local governments who, can't withstand the threat of legal action and the power of very wealthy landowners on the coast. Now, not everyone's wealthy, but a lot are, and they can wield their might. And there's been some developments and buildings on the retreat zone areas that have been pretty intrusive and pretty bold. And people get away with it. And so that's been a major issue in the area, and it changes the nature of the coastline and also brings into question the whole question of private ownership, control of beaches. You put rock walls in, you lose your public beach. And that's something, again, a different thing, very sacred to the Australian population. We don't have privatised beaches like they do all up and down the coast in America.
That's right. So we have essentially continuous right of way along the coastline, save for geographic features which make it impassable, like you know, points and
sort of lands and rocky outcrops and such like. And this general push by people who are understandably wanting to maintain their properties, then becomes a situation, I've seen evidence of it, where you lose the beach. You put a rock wall down and you lose the beach. And once you've lost the beach,
that's... And why does that happen? Because the waves come up to that rock wall, which is there to protect the land.
Cavitates, yeah. And it scours out underneath, and you lose the natural sort of build-up and attrition of the beach. And so, therefore, the public loses what's arguably the most powerful and valuable asset in a place like Byron Bay, which is the ability to walk along magnificent beaches that are in a relatively natural order. And to the untrained eye, it's pretty perfect. It's a struggle all round.
I think it's really telling when you walk past some of the real estate agent shops in Byron Bay, and they often, and I'm wondering whether this is actually wise, but they often use, you know, aerial shots, like drone shots, particularly to show you where a particular house is at Belongil, for example, and you can see that tidal river at the back that's flowing out, and you can see the beach at the front, and you realise it's actually a relatively thin spit of land with all those houses.
And that area there is just as likely to be inundated from behind as it is to be inundated from the front. It's a bit like the guns of Singapore. You're focusing the wrong way. And so
I wonder about insurance there as well. I mean, that must be pretty iffy.
Yeah. I think all these problems, whether it be fire, floods, cyclones, you know, incremental rises in ocean level and incremental rises in temperature lend themselves towards greater summertime cyclonic storm activity, and therefore we've got an exacerbation of all the problems that have been existing. And, you know, every 20, 30 years, there was 1954, we lost a whole village called Burning Palms to the north of Brunswick Heads. They had to evacuate. It is no more. There is no real evidence of it. In 74, I was travelling up this coast and it was monumental. It was a big, again, East Coast low coming up in about July, and it wiped out significant areas of the coast and had water running like a river down Johnson Street in Byron Bay. So once the ocean is unleashed in its fury, it is, you know, it certainly puts us in our place, I think, and people continue to build in erosion zones and coastal areas. Really, it's been well known. That's our argument, I suppose. It's not like something that's just happened unexpectedly. There's been a pattern of this ocean behaviour for forever. And it's been well recorded by scientists, and it is another reason why I live on a hill here, close to the coast, but quite well elevated, because the area of this property, which is literal rainforest, has got deposits of very ancient sand dunes. So once upon
just,
a time,
just if I can stop you there just for a sec, because I used that term literal rainforest, and I know that sounded very clever of me, but in fact, I got it from you when we chatted yesterday. So just explain what literal rainforest.
Well,
means.
It's a type of forest that is to be found behind coastal dunes on the coast itself. There's just a few patches of significant coastal rainforest or literal rainforest, littoral rather than literal.
Yes, like rather than
being literal. Educated. there's very few patches of it remaining, and the natural landform has lent itself to protection in this particular area.
Right.
And it is very important as a type of ecosystem to maintain as much as we possibly can.
And what lives here? What are the sort of, if people were here, what would they see? There's obviously some, what do they call them, scrub turkeys around?
Oh, there's plenty of scrub turkeys around. There's koalas just further down the hill. They don't like the literal rainforest itself, but they're...
Because they're more into the eucalypt country.
They're in the eucalypt country, which is just walking distance away, you know, a few hills back, and quite a significant koala area. There's all manner of snakes.
Wallabies?
Wallabies, these sort of little sort of forest-dwelling wallabies that are very prolific, particularly around our veggie garden. It's an ongoing battle. But there's a huge range, all sorts of small marsupials plant types and insect types that haven't necessarily been properly scientifically investigated, because it's a refuge area, you know, and there is stuff that gathers on our windows at night that, you know, I take pictures of, we've never seen before, insects that are attracted by the light.
Right.
And it's quite a rich resource for scientists. We've had scientists from Southern Cross University come onto the property and ask permission to dig some holes to just temporarily trap, you know, various native animals, which they've been welcomed. That's part of what it's here for. And it's quite a wealth of, microbats too, little horseshoe bats and bent wing bats and massive amounts living on the incredible insect life. So it's in reasonable harmony. And we try to keep it that way.
Well, you're someone who's really living what it is that you've advocated in public life, in politics and as a campaigner. You really are. I mean, you see this as this landholding that you have here as, I suppose, a private reserve. That is, you own it at the moment, but your intention is for it to be maintained in perpetuity as reserve.
Yeah, the property was shared, and other shareholders, owners, didn't agree with sort of putting that power over the state, And I'm very enthusiastic about it. So I'm now in a position to do that, and I will be doing that, and I'll be looking at what neighbours might be doing of similar ilk, and that we can really sort of lock up some areas, not that they wouldn't be used, but used sensitively, getting away from car traffic and absolutely sort of rapacious attitude toward this as a type of a recreational area, and use it as you will, to really sensitively using it and having people come with a sense of awe. And that is what sustained me to a great extent, and I'm really happy to share it, but share it in a way that people come with respect. And I think that also applies to the incredible pressure that the public nature reserve areas in this shire are suffering from, because obviously, Byron Bay is a household word. It's associated with parties, doofs, and conservation, and obviously healing and all sorts of interesting alternative modalities. But in that, there is a contradiction. There's a sort of a clash between utilizing a resource and sort of using it up and damaging it, to protecting the resource and having people come along to walk the roads into the reserves and enjoy the beauty of it without actually damaging it. And that's that sort of light footprint that we'd like to develop as an ethos. It's all there in lots of talk and government propaganda and everything, as they continue to encourage people to come into areas that aren't actually geared up and equipped to deal with the onslaught of tourists, particularly now with COVID coming up and all the issues that evolve around that, and people's need for this type of recreational opportunity and this soul healing process. How do we do it? How do we fit them in where everybody's happy, particularly the animals on the road that just happen to be blinded by the lights at the wrong time?
Yeah, which is just terrible when you see that. And then, and I noticed the number of the locals around here, and even on Broken Head Reserve Road, for example, they're coming into this area. There are signs that are quite clearly been made by locals asking motorists to slow down, even below the 50K limit, because animals are crossing, koalas and other things.
Exactly. So if everyone travelled at that pace, not only would they have a chance, the animals would have a chance, but the drivers would have a chance of viewing some fantastic animals. A Spangled Drongo, a mate of mine who's a surfer, he said, look, he couldn't believe it. There was a Spangled.
Hang on, your mate's called Spangled Drongo.
No, sorry. That really got unclear. You'll have to edit that. But there was a Spangled Drongo on the road, which is a beautiful satin black bird and extremely valued ecologically. And it just got bowled over by a speeding car. And he was incredulous, thinking, well, why does that car, just to go another 10, 15 kilometres an hour in a 50 zone, that bird is gone. It's gone forever. Mm. There is not the snake that I can show you pictures of that stretched right out across the road here on the dirt road. It's not around anymore. I used to see it regularly, and a snake like that was a big fella or lady or whatever, and you'd stop.
Was that a python?
Python, yeah, and you'd stop. I haven't seen that for several years, and I know that I would if it was still alive.
Yeah, that's really sad. Just before we leave the country, you mentioned before that it has an interesting indigenous past. I wonder if you could just explain who the traditional owners of this land were.
Yeah, well, it's the Arakwal custodians of the Bundjalung Nation, and they lived on this land, and I've walked this land with a lady called Auntie Lorna, who, you know, she was just the most amazing woman. You know, she just walk along there on the tracks barefooted, and they lived and grew up in these coves, and Bray's Beach is one of the Aboriginal elders who used to fish down there and live down there, and that they have a very powerful connection to the land. And also there's a series of articles written about 20 years ago by a journalist called Peter Ellum called Rivers of Blood, and he describes the massacres that occurred in this area, and they actually chased the local Aboriginal people up and trapped them in some of the beach areas and waited for the tide to come up and slaughtered them, you know. So it is a story of prior very strong connection with the land. It is a story of people who are still connected with them being alive today. And the good part of the story is that a significant number of those people are employed in national parks on country, and they won awards. The old ladies, the sisters, went and travelled to South Africa to get an international award for the whole development of the Indigenous Land Use Agreement and the relationship between local Aboriginal people, their recognition, and the fact that they had gotten, might I say, without sort of interfering with their rules, might I say, where they got recognition and certain areas were protected and acknowledged as their sacred sites, they gave the community one of the hottest properties in Byron Bay itself. They gave it to them to build a library. So it's a fantastic sort of giving back and generosity on the part of these local Indigenous people, which I think gets lost in time.
It does.
And
it does.
That's, to me, something that, well, you know, I'm older generation now, so I like to raise that issue as much as possible, just how much those people have given back and how generous they've been, considering the difficulties they've faced.
And how forgiving they
Absolutely.
Have been, considering that bloody history. Let's,
yes.
You know, let's be frank about it, as you were. It's and that's really the story of Indigenous white relations in Australia over the whole journey, is this this amazing tolerance, really, or generosity that has been extended over time, given the way this relationship started, and indeed the way dispossession has continued. So we certainly, I take this opportunity, I'm sure you share this view, to pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land, as we do at the beginning of this podcast always. We'll take a break now, and afterwards we'll talk about your attempts to stop a warship by hand, personally. Back in a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, as I was just saying before the break, Ian Cohen did try and stop a warship with his bare hands. Let's go to that, because people in New South Wales, you know, they'll know your name, of course, be very familiar with you from your long parliamentary service, and others in the environmental movement, of course, will know you. And many will know also, or if they think back to the dark reaches of their memory, they'll remember an extraordinary photo or vision of a man, this is way back in 1986, a man on a surfboard trying to stop, or at least draw attention to, the entry of the USS Oldendorf, I think it was, an American destroyer as it was coming into Sydney Harbour. And now, look, tell us about that, because that is just an extraordinary piece of history that you can talk about firsthand, which doesn't happen often.
It was a sort of a series of developments. I was very bright-eyed, bushy-tailed back in those days, and I helped out the Nuclear Disarmament Party campaign for the 1984 election. And
that was the one where Peter Garrett was the lead Senate candidate,
almost got in, and then was sort of very much involved in the whole anti-uranium industry. So But I didn't have a great deal of resource. You know, I was running around on my wits, and then we got announcements that there was going to be the biggest armada of undeclared, neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, that was the US policy. Nuclear weapons or nuclear power of their vessels.
That's right, coming into our harbours right around Australia for the 175th naval anniversary. It was a big do, and so I very enthusiastically got together with groups like Greenpeace and the remnants of the Nuclear Disarmament Party, and we sort of formed the Sydney Peace Squadron and the Brisbane Peace and Environment Fleet. And I, when at the early stages, you know, it was all friendly camaraderie, but the people in Greenpeace had fantastic equipment and laughed at me. What are you going to go out on there? And I thought to myself, well, gee, you know, all I've got's a surfboard. And you sort of use what you've got. And they all thought it was hilarious. And the first ship coming through, which closed the ports of New Zealand, and we saw all the protests there, and it, you know, it was pretty inspirational.
Yeah.
And
was that the Longy government at the time?
It was.
Yeah. And,
yes.
And the government had banned the entry of nuclear powered vessels.
Nuclear armed.
Nuclear armed, right.
This is a neither confirmed nor denied, but it's nuclear armed. There's no question about nuclear power coming at that time.
Right.
And so they were, you know, they were the mouse that roared, and it was fantastic for us in the peace movement and, you know, those radical political circles. Anyway, so I had my surfboard and I was on a yacht. And I had no idea exactly what I'd do with my surfboard on a yacht, except the captain was tacking back and forth across the path of, and you see this massive ship coming in. And this isn't the big day. I'm just going back a tiny bit in history. Mm. And he yelled at me, "This is as close as I'm getting." And I thought, "Oh, okay." So I jumped off my surfboard and paddled across the front of the ship and duly got dragged in by the cops saying what an idiot I was, and then watched as they put me into the slowest boat in the protest fleet as I missed all the action, and I could see all the Zodiacs and Greenpeace sort of being what I saw as being really effective, you know, half a kilometre down the harbour. Mm. And then after it all, they all sort of gave me a hard time because I got left behind, which I did.
Mm.
But that next day, and in the evening news, it said protester risked death. And was that me? Yes, it was me. Was I really? Yes, I guess maybe, but not necessarily. And that grabbed the attention of the media. And so I sort of, you know, lay awake at night thinking, how can I develop this? And
wow.
You know, imagine if I
this
could.
This story gets better and better.
Yeah. And I thought, how can I do it? And I started practice runs, because the ships were coming in with regularity, and I started practice runs between Brisbane and Sydney, demonstrating on a surfboard and hanging on the nose of the ships, but the media wasn't there.
Wow.
So they didn't see it. So what I did
was... So it wasn't
was,
even the first time you'd done it.
No, it was probably about the fifth time that I'd done it, but in Sydney it was the big day.
Mm.
The boats were everywhere. The media was everywhere. So it was the media that manufactured the image, and
well, I think
I was
you manufactured
well,
the image.
I was
they
just
took the photo.
I was just the bait on the hook, you know? and so this image, and I got onto the front of the Oldendorf, which it was, you know, like it needed commitment. It's sort of like riding a big wave, you know. You needed commitment, and I managed to get into position from a Zodiac, and the ships were coming at me. And one of the things when they're in formation, things that big can't move.
Yeah.
So you can really sort it out in your mind.
And presumably once that you get fairly close, then they can't even see you anymore.
No, they had ratings looking through the sort of the anchor chain holes at the top to see what in the hell this idiot was doing. Oh, yeah, they were all having a go. But I managed to do that, and what happened was the Sydney Morning Herald and the TV news has got fantastic footage. They were on a flat-bottom boat directly in front of me, all facing my way and going back. So it was just one of those media opportunities that sort of fall your way. And by that time, I was fairly skilled. So I had this ride of my life up Sydney Harbour and, of course, was duly arrested at the end of it all.
And charged, presumably?
Oh, yes. I was charged with obstruction. And I had a great lawyer and he went right through the whole thing and sort of how absurd it was. And I got off the charges because a sort of an 80 kilo person on a 5 kilo surfboard or 10 kilo surfboard is not going to really obstruct a warship.
Did not really impede its progress.
No. So, and that was like, it was fun times. It was exhilarating. It was a case of getting the message across the media, using the media and attracting them to the bait like vultures, and they can't help themselves. And so it was a successful campaign in some ways, but after the ships were docked, they then had people coming down to visit the ships, and the population swelled out of the city in such numbers that they virtually had rights down there at the docking cockatoo, the docking area not far from the quay. And it made me think, well, it doesn't matter what we do, the media and the general population are really set in their ways of absolutely spellbound by these ships of war. And I realized just how difficult it would be to have a significant impact other than on people who already felt the same way as you did.
That's really an interesting realization, because it kind of goes to where I was planned to go with the next question anyway, and that was to, I suppose, talk about what you learned from that. And then, you know, like a decade or so later, a bit less than that, you turn up in the New South Wales Parliament. So you've gone from kind of outsider to insider in a way. You were surfing on your wits, really, clinging onto the front of a board, front of a boat with, you know, one of your few possessions on your surfboard. And in 1995, you enter the New South Wales Upper House. So you're now inside the kind of establishment in a way, albeit as the Parliament's first Green MP. Was that a natural development of that realisation that there are limits to what you can achieve through protest, through persuasion of that method?
Look, I think, you know, I sway back and forward. I can see where protest on the streets is invaluable, and I'll always have great sympathy for that function. And I can see just how powerful the parliaments are in terms of being able to potentially get in there to change things. But I started my political career because I was asked by the Greens. They couldn't get a candidate to run for the Senate. And this was a year after I did the warship stuff. So I had quite a significant profile as an activist. And I was asked by the Greens to run for the Senate. And I thought to myself,
The federal Senate.
They had no one. No one wanted to do it. No one in the more serious sort of parts of the movement really wanted to touch this type of radical organizations and radical behavior and such like. And so I thought, okay, here's an opportunity to actually raise the issues. And that's what the first couple of election runs were all about. Although 87, Bob Hawke was running again, and they did a double dissolution. So I only needed 7% to get up.
Yeah, and that's right. Smaller quota. You're electing 12 senators.
And so I actually came very close, and they elected a nuclear disarmament party person, Rob Woods, in front of me. But so it was close. It sort of whetted my appetite to it. Plus the fact that, you know, I was pretty well declared as completely unemployable. I had no other choice in life, you know, to become a politician. But I sort of kept at that, raising the issues and raising them well. Getting up in front of Howard's launch at the State Theatre and just getting really close and being able to sneak in there, disguised as Liberal, of course, and you know, yell out the slogans. You know, was he going to damn the Franklin again? All those big issues that they were big issues back in the 80s.
You'd been involved in the Franklin below Gordon, is it? Gordon below Franklin? Issue as well. So these are some of the big environmental fights that we're talking about, aren't they? You know, Roxby Downs, you know, the whole uranium thing in South Australia, the US warships, nuclear power is an issue.
Yeah.
And of course the one we're talking about, the amazing success story really of Australian environmentalism there in Tasmania.
Yes. Well, it was a time when we really had a certain moral ascendancy and we were sort of tracking a new path historically, and the green movement going from, we were just dirty, unwashed rat bags. That's what we were called, to, greenies, in the Franklin River campaign. And then out of that came the sort of maturation of the Greens. And so I sort of followed that trend where a lot of people who were involved, Bob Brown's a classic example, where he went right through from being the very peaceful conservative but still archetypal protest leader at the Franklin River campaign, and we all just absolutely admired his style and tenacity and calm in all those situations, that he was a great teacher, that he went then through the Tasmanian Parliament and gay law reform and really, copped it hard and stood firmly against it, to becoming a senator in the federal parliament. So that was inspirational, and I was there when we formed the Australian Greens as an organisation and kept pushing for what I believed in. I mean, I was offered positions with the Democrats at the time. They were much more mature. I said, look, I can't go under any label except the Greens. I believed in it. I'd found a sort of a religion, I have to admit, something to believe in, a future to believe in. And as a result of that, I kept on with the Greens until I stumbled into Parliament in 1995.
This issue of the relationship between protest and parliamentary service, or being prepared to speak the language of institutionalism and relate to people, to the attempt to persuade people to your point of view, it's a really fascinating one. I've long been interested in this. I remember hearing a story about John Bannon, the South Australian Premier, when he'd been at university. He used to attend anti-Vietnam marches, I think it was, wearing a suit. And people would ask him, what are you doing? They're sort of at the front of the march.
Yeah.
And this young, left-leaning but conservative-looking activist would answer that his job wasn't to win over the people that already won over, it was to win over the others, so that when they see the evening news and they see this protest, they see themselves in the crowd as well as people who aren't them. And in a way, Bob Brown did that as well.
Absolutely.
He was a GP.
Yes.
He, as you say, he actually presented this kind of stately, calm, almost conservative kind of disposition when he spoke, and yet he stood very firmly for these quite radical change ideas.
Yeah, a true radical, opposing all the fashions and norms of the time. Why aren't you part of the great unwashed, et cetera, et cetera? And it was funny because down at the Franklin River, I accompanied Bob and a whole bunch of people on an early stage of the campaign where he had decided he was going to get arrested, and he sort of said, for heaven's sake, don't everyone get arrested today. We need you all for the weeks to come.
Yeah.
And we walked through the forest and it was great, and we got to a place called Warner's Landing, which was a particularly beautiful little cool temperate stream and rainforest palms everywhere. And Bob stopped, and out of his day pack, whatever it was, he pulled a tie and he put on a tie. I said, you've got to be joking. And he said, no. He said, we've all got to do it the way we feel comfortable. I go, okay, fair enough, good point. So he was arrested on the Franklin River at the very beginning of the campaign wearing a sort of like a tweed jacket and a tie.
And I think that probably was a very powerful message across middle Australia. It wasn't all just people with dreadlocks and who hadn't had a shower for a few weeks.
No, it resonated. It absolutely resonated. And on the other hand, I was long haired when I had hair and bearded at the Franklin. I was living in the forest and I looked like it. I was a quintessential greenie, and a lot of the cartoons sort of depicted me, looked like it. And the Wilderness Society said, Ian, look, nothing personal, just stay out of the media. We don't want that image And I thought, well, fair enough. You know, I've actually from previous campaigns had been locked out of those roles and gone and become very comfortable being on the ground. And that's where I felt I wanted to be, you know, digging holes and fixing up paths and making people comfortable when they come into a really challenging environment of actually living in a tent down in the wilderness, leeches and the whole bit sort of all over them and having to deal with that because it rained that summer virtually every day. They'd never had such a wet season down there, but we were there for months on end and we reveled in it. So yes, it's just, I guess it's an appreciation, A, of protest and supportive politics and supportive legals. When they're all synced in and working together, it's an incredibly powerful set of campaign tools. And one without the other just crashes against the
Because they have their limitations.
They do. You know, I went I went twice to the Daintree for the campaigns. Where the second one, the mainstream conservation groups just were unable, didn't have the go in them to support us, and left us high and dry with Joe Bjelke-Petersen's police force in the rainforest, the Daintree, and that included the riot squad with dogs and people getting mauled and pretty heavy stuff. And that's the other end of the branch that you're sort of sitting on, and they're cutting it down below you, you know. And so it is a case of working a balance between protest. And, you know, after I got elected, I still protested. I remember burning a post. I almost got the sprinklers going in the parliamentary press room, burning a big poster of the Southeast Forests when the Carr government was ignoring some of the pleas of the conservation movement to actually do something constructive. But then in hindsight, I also see that the pressures against conservation have been monumental, especially, you know, with a Labor government. They have, you know, on one shoulder is the unions. Many of them aren't conservationists at all. Some are, but they're there protecting jobs and their livelihood. And that's still reflected in the COVID crisis now. So these are all massive pressures upon governments that you realize just how tiny you are. But we were for the first 4 years, in a very constructive relationship with the Carr government and saved a lot of forests. And we were sharing with a group of disparate independents, we were sharing the balance of power in the upper house. So we had quite a significant amount of power.
And you found yourself being courted or duchessed or kept in contact, however you like to call it, by some guys that have, I guess, become pretty notorious in Australian politics, Eddie O'Bee and Ian McDonald
They had a job in the upper house to keep me happy and to sort of win me over for the government's other aspects of the agenda by conveying to the government, because they didn't have portfolios, and the rumour has it they'd get portfolios if they could control us greenies at the time. But they were there, and we had a sort of a jovial, sometimes difficult working relationship. But often,
let's just say you fared better out of the history than they have.
Well, that's true. And there was another guy called Brian Langton who was a great guy, real cheeky. He's sort of the size of a jockey, and he was very, very smart. And he came up to my office one day and said, I just had a great meeting, cabinet meeting. I banged the table and that Ian Cohen says this and really ripped into the whole cabinet and got his way on some significant things in his portfolio. I knew nothing about it, but he was able to use me and build me up bigger than what I was in reality to actually get that leverage and win away. So everyone was playing sort of clever political games then, and we did get some significant advances in forest conservation.
So you've had, as someone on the green side and the green movement in the conservation movement, you've had exposure to all of those complexities. You would have insights, therefore, into that perhaps some of the people on the front line of the protest movement are sometimes blind to, you'd have insights into all the different, as you were just saying, all the different interests that particularly mainstream political parties, parties of government that aspire to be in government, are trying to balance all the time. You can see where I'm going with this. I'm coming to coal. Joel Fitzgibbon, Labor frontbencher, thinks that the Labor Party might eventually have to split. He's not saying it'll happen in his lifetime, but he's talking about the tension that exists between, I guess, the aspirations of the inner cities, which Labor needs to form government, but also the regions. Joel Fitzgibbon represents a lot of coal industry workers. Do you have, I guess I got a couple of questions about this. Do you have some sympathy for a party that's trying to straddle those quite different poles of interest? And do you think that that the Labor Party can continue to do it, or will it eventually just become too hard?
It's the relationship with coal there is this dinosaur politics.
But there are, that's true, but there are people employed in that industry.
Yes, I agree. I agree. But it's our responsibility as a society
to transition them.
And we've seen with COVID the capacity of even conservative governments to help all sorts of people and communities to survive in an almost socialist manner. And so they can do it when they, when they recognize it and it's for the good in the medium and long term, that they can actually stop and go, hey, we've got a serious emergency, and emerge out of their narrow-minded politics. And the coal industry is all about narrow-minded politics and the opportunities that we have as an advanced industrialized nation with all sorts of capacities. Like the fact that Howard refused to help fund that Chinese entrepreneur that went off to China with his newly developed solar panels, and in a very short period of time became one of the richest men in China. That says it all in my book. That could be jobs by their hundreds of thousands and wealth in export dollars sitting in somewhere like the desert of South Australia. So, you know, it is our responsibility to find those ways forward. But I feel, and Labor and the coalition, you know, the Prime Minister with his piece of coal in his hand in Parliament, this is all just really cheap politics. It's missing the point. They're scaring the hell out of people, like they like to do with everything, and they're impeding movement forward that could be extremely productive for everybody.
And giving false comfort to people in an industry that does not have a long-term future.
No, well, it's, you know, who knows when they get to a point where the alternative power industry solutions actually, and they are, overtaking coal as a viable economic option, that they'll dump those industries, and they're dumping them already. Mm. I mean, you know, coal prices.
Obviously, the banks are.
Yeah. And so and then they flip up the nuclear industry because it's pressure from lobby groups and people who have got a vast amount of power, and putting those industrialists into, you know, committees and such like that are supposed to be looking after our future. It's testimony to the power of the, I'll call it gutter media. I suppose I shouldn't be using such terms, that can really twist people's reality around to sort of not get a balanced view and not be able to understand the nuances of these arguments. So I don't accept Joel Fitzgibbon. I put him in the same basket as what's his name, now the head of One Nation in New South Wales, ex-Labor leader.
Oh, Mark Latham.
Mark Latham.
I was going to say, I'm not familiar with who's the leader in New South Wales, but unfortunately I am.
Yeah. Aren't we lucky that we didn't get him in as some sort of Labor prime minister? So...
amazing turn of history that. Let me just finish. We're running a little bit out of time here, but let me just finish with a question about the Greens. What do you think the future of the Greens are? Some people think that it could end up being like the Nats are to the Liberals. That is, in a sort of a permanent coalition partner of Labor. That obviously has some tension with the previous question asked and the subject matter there. But,
yeah.
I mean, the Greens are, as a third force, have been much more stable than other forces, probably because they've been built around a very powerful idea rather than a person. I mean, we see those sort of eponymous parties like the Clive Palmer Party or Pauline Hanson's One Nation. Yeah. These things tend to be very short-lived. The Democrats looked like they were that third force for a while, but then went by the wayside rather dramatically. Yeah, Greens have stayed on, but does the party have a long-term future?
I think so. I think there is a real need there, but at the same time, we need to protect ourselves because there are opportunities in the Greens now where people can come along, realizing that they can get a very high-profile, high-powered job. And so you get those professionals
careerists,
and so that can be a problem. And there's also quite sort of different perspectives within the Greens. It's a broad church. You've got your people who are very would have answered the Joel Fitzgibbon question very differently to what I had, and they're much more sort of socially oriented and industrially driven. In terms of workers' rights and such like, so there is a broad spectrum and a fair bit of conflict within the Greens itself. I think.
Well, you've seen a fair bit of that in the New South Wales branch.
Yeah, well, I guess I feel I've been a green. I think that the ecology and environment are the top of the pyramid, and I've had some pretty strong arguments with people who see social issues, which I, like to feel I've abided by for many years and been involved in those social issues before I became an environmentalist. But it does lend itself to takeover of people who are sort of very skilled at meeting process and pushing their way through with a certain set of ideals. But there's still the opportunity within the Greens, sort of the grassroots democracy aspects, for people to actually come back and say, no, we don't want to go down that road. We actually want you to focus more back on the environmental issues, but we include the job components and supporting industries that are supporting the environment. So it's not an easy road. It's going to be fraught with continuing issues, but I think by and large, we've got a huge sort of resource of people who are very, very idealistic and dedicated, and there's an amazing crossover into the small G green movement of people who are out there. I want to see a film. There's some young guy that sort of climbed trees on Kangaroo Island and saved about 200 koalas after the recent fires.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
That type of thing, where you just go, well, my hat off to him and all those people who are, well, like I was, perhaps misguided, but still out there, right out there on a limb, and they've got no investment in the situation except their ideals.
Yeah, it's a brilliant note to end on. Ian Cohen, thanks for joining us on Democracy Sausage Extra. It's been a great privilege talking to you, especially sitting in this country here. I can say we just did our 100th podcast only a few days ago, but in all of those podcasts, we've never had anyone on who's surfed the bow wave of a USS destroyer. So USS Oldendorf it was, American destroyer. So that's something of a privilege to talk to you, a piece of political protest history. And it's been great talking to you today.
And politically, I've flogged the image to death ever since.
Good on you. Thank you for joining Democracy Sausage, for listening to us today. We'll be back on Monday with another episode. And until then, bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.